Blog Talk Radio.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
This is Radio Free America on ConservativeNationMedia.com. Duke Brooks here. Glad you could make it. Tonight is the 72nd anniversary of the Battle of Midway. Absolutely crucial battle in World War II. And we've got some great experts that are going to be joining us. John Parshall will be with us. And I believe I've got Mr. Barrett Tillman here. Barrett, is that
Hello
you?
Hello there. I'm here.
How are you doing? Thanks so much for being along with us tonight.
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to join you and John. And I have to say, when you've got John, you have the Midway universe at your fingertips.
Yeah, that's about right. He will be calling in just a couple of minutes. But now, so many people, of course, know you from all of the appearances that you make on various programs on the History Channel, like Dogfights and, the various programs that they have. Tell us a little bit about that, and then I want to speak with you about your recent book.
Excuse me. First network TV appearances was on a National Geographic series called Dead Man's Secrets, and that was, I think it was a two-hour special around 2004, following up on the discovery of a wrecked U.S. Navy fighter, a Grumman Wildcat on Guadalcanal, that had been shot down by one of the prominent Japanese fighter aces, Saburo Sakai. And
right.
that was so well received that the producers of the Dogfight series contacted me and asked if I would be available to be a talking head and a script reviewer for the 2 years that Dogfights was run on the History Channel. And that was in 2006 and 2007. And I think I was on 10 or 12 of those, roughly half of the segments that were aired, and it was just a lot of fun, Duke. I got to work with people I'd known for years and years, and then I also got to meet some new friends. So it was a really worthwhile experience.
Well, those programs are wonderful, and it's always, I've been just a huge World War II buff my whole life, but you have done more than just been interested in World War II. You have made a living out of studying and writing about military history. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I came by it honestly. My father was a naval aviation cadet in World War II, and he had opted for the Marine Corps. So in my little bitty hometown in northeastern Oregon, I spent a lot of time as a youngster at the local crop duster strip, which was owned by my mother's family, and I started flying at age 16. And over the next several years, I got an absolute blessing of an experience with my father and some other members of our antique airplane club. We acquired what was, at that time, in the early 1970s, the only flying example of the Douglas SPD Dauntless, of which we'll be discussing a lot more in context of the Battle of Midway. And that in turn spurred my interest in my first book, which was an operational history of the SPD, which, oddly enough, had never been done. So that book was published by Naval Institute Press in 1976, and here we are, 38 years later, and it's still in print.
Wonderful. Now, let me ask you this. When did your dad go through Pensacola?
He didn't go to Pensacola. He was at Corpus Christi in 1943. He had started in the CPT program, which was a civilian pilot training program that was a lead-in pre-flight, if you will, for both the Army Air Force and the Navy. And Dad completed CPT at Nampa, Idaho, and then went to NAS Pasco in southeastern Washington, and from there he went to Corpus Christi.
My dad was commissioned at Pensacola, a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps Reserve, in May of 1943. And I would not be at all surprised if your dad and mine crossed paths at some point. But
well, that's certainly
possible. Tell me more. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Tell me more about your dad's flying experience in the Marines of World War II.
Well, he was one of a handful of Marine aviators. I think it was roughly 3% who were never deployed overseas. And he got out immediately after the war and returned to Oregon and met my mother and turned up in the wheat business. And as Dad just died earlier this year at age 92.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, thank you. He was an absolute inspiration. My father got polio visiting an Army friend in Puerto Rico in 1946. And that was 2 years before I was born. So Dad made, I would say, about an 80% recovery. And I flew between 500 and 600 hours with him, mainly in the N3N, which was a Navy biplane trainer, much like the N2S Sherman. Yes, that's exactly
the
right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And even though his lower legs were atrophied from the polio, he continued flying rudder airplanes up until, I think he was almost 60 by the time he hung it up. So I had tremendous respect for my dad, not only as an inspirational parent, but as an excellent aviator.
Well, that is tremendous. My dad's attitude about me flying was over my dead body, and he died on January 1st, 1975, and by the 10th, I was out at the airport taking my lessons. But, you know, that's I guess to him, flying meant that there were Japs that were shooting at you and trying to kill you. And, you know, he just didn't like, I suppose. His squadron was VMF 111. And
oh, sure, Devil Dogs.
Devil Dogs, yeah. I did see somewhere on the internet that your new book, USMC Fighter Squadrons of World War II, basically describes how my dad and his squadron won the war all by themselves. Isn't that right?
Well, I would grant the other 49 Marine fighter squadrons in the Pacific a supporting role. How's that?
Well, it you know, it must have been an unbelievable time, and to be doing something like flying the 4U Corsair when you're 22 years old, I think it's just unbelievable, absolutely incredible. I do expect to hear from John Parshall, who, as many people know, is the author of what I think will be, along with Tony Tully, I think will be considered to be the definitive book on Midway for years to come, called Shattered Sword, and Tom Cleaver, former Hollywood screenwriter, will be joining us soon. He's the author, I think most recently, of Fabled 15, about the Carrier Air Group 15 in World War II. But, Barrett, as a matter of fact, I believe we've got, let's see, is that Thomas or is this John? You're on the air. Is this Thomas or
John?
Yeah,
hi. How you doing, Duke?
I'm doing fine. Barrett Tillman's already with us, Tom.
I hear. I've been listening. I had not heard all that stuff about your dad before, Barrett. It was good to hear.
Oh,
well, thank you.
Yeah.
I do remember that I saw you. I saw you land that N3N up at Abbotsford in 1977.
No,
didn't
I don't
it
remember
was you at
that.
The time, but I found that out later.
My gosh! Yeah, our antique club. We called ourselves the Scarf and Goggles Club. It was corrupted to Scarf and Gargle. We're a regular at Abbotsford from, I guess it was probably about 1967 onward. So I'm glad to know we shared ramp space.
we were up there. If you remember the Corsair that was in Suez markings,
yeah,
I'd help restore that airplane. Unfortunately, that airplane crashed a few years ago after it was given the tender mercies of an air museum. We'll leave quiet now.
Thomas, is that the Dash 7 that was also Mad Max?
It was not Mad Max. Blue Max.
Blue Max
was a different airplane,
yeah.
which also crashed.
Yeah.
But 133722 was the last by 10. There were 10 more after it before the production line closed down, which made it the oldest one left still in existence. And the guy who had it had found it in the early 70s. He was a pilot for Pan Am at the time, and he was sitting in a bar in Paris, and he met a guy who had been a petty officer in the French Navy, who had put the thing in a warehouse at the Toulon Navy base after it had been used as an instructional airframe in 1964, and this was 1972, and he found that it was still there. And by 1974, by 1973, it was in Half Moon Bay, California, where I got to spend 6 months helping them strip it down. It had never been through a maintenance unit, just more blue paint over it from each unit, which we effectively cocooned it in paint.
Yes,
and
you bet.
Six layers down, we found the Suez markings, which I, being a modeler, recognized. And I said, this is important.
The black and yellow stripes.
Yeah, and I said, this is important, guys. So we photographed all of the markings and measured them, and I took them as slides. So that when 2 years later, when it was painted, we just put the slide on the airplane and put it up to the right proper size and painted it.
Oh boy, that's terrific.
For a long time, it was the only warbird flying in operational markings of a historical event that particular specific airframe had carried.
Yeah, even today that's a rare occurrence. Wow.
Yeah, and of course then when Stephen Gray had it for a lot of years in Europe, and then it got sold to the air museum that shall not be named, where they stripped it down and repainted it as a Korean War airplane and said, well, of course there is an American airplane.
Oh,
gosh.
Yeah.
Another
crime against history.
John, welcome aboard.
You say I'm with you, but you know I could actually still be hiding here in the shadows, just listening to Barrett et al. Talking.
To Barrett and Tom.
Hi, John.
Yes, exactly.
Hello. So I'm
John,
back from War College.
Yeah.
Yes, earlier today I was about to say you were at the Naval War College in Rhode Island giving the keynote address on the 72nd anniversary of the battle. It was yesterday.
It's their end of term, and you know they wanted to get their celebration in at an appropriate time for their students, which makes sense. So even though the actual anniversary of the battle is today.
Well, yesterday was
yes.
the anniversary
right.
of the Air Force winning.
Of the Air Force win. I'm sorry.
Yesterday was the anniversary of the Air Force winning when they bombed them with B-17s.
Well, yeah, I mean the invasion convoy, but yeah, not the carriers.
That
obviously.
Is a joke.
that too.
I don't think that the Air Force scored any actual hits of any
not
significance
one.
At all.
Not
yeah,
one.
During that phase of the battle, 20, on 21 the
day
before,
bombs and not one.
Yeah, it's I guess it's a tough thing to do, but John, why don't you kind of set the stage for us a little bit in this discussion of Midway, and let's go back to early June 1942, and I say this to people often, And especially these young kids today, they look at me like I've got three heads, but the United States was losing World War II for at least the first 5 months that we were engaged in it.
Right.
And we had finally gotten a strategic victory against Japan in early May at the Battle of the Coral Sea, and now it's about a month later. And John, take it away. Let us know where we were, what was happening, and why.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you had been a kid sitting around the dinner table listening to your parents for the first 5 or 6 months of this war, you know, you would have heard a lot of pretty tense conversations. You would have heard a lot of place names that you had probably not been familiar with before, you know, names like Malaya and Singapore and Corregidor and Bataan, and would have definitely gotten the vibe that things have been going very, very badly for the U.S. and for the Allies in general. You know, the Japanese had been triumphant everywhere they had gone for the past the past 5 months, and it wasn't just at Pearl Harbor. You know, they had invaded the Philippines, invaded Malaya, got into Java and Borneo and Burma and blah, 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 blah. And then by about April, you know, they've carved one of the largest empires in history out of the Western Pacific and Southeast Asia. So I don't know that there was necessarily a sense of desperation yet, but it certainly was a very bruising, humiliating time for the American psyche. And there were a lot of people kind of questioning, you know, whether or not we can actually beat these guys. So what ends up happening, of course, is that the Japanese are trying to figure out, well, okay, we've gotten all the raw materials that we've gone to war for. What's next? And the driver of that strategic discussion is Admiral Yamamoto of Combined Fleet. And he eventually gets his way, and his basic strategic reasoning is that the only naval assets really left to the Americans of any noteworthiness were their aircraft carriers, and those carriers are based out of Pearl Harbor. I would like to create a naval battle somewhere close enough to Pearl Harbor that I can draw those carriers out, but far enough away from the organic air power on Oahu that it can't get tangled up in this battle that I'm trying to create. And secondarily, if I can figure out a way to actually capture Hawaii, that could be a very useful bargaining chip with the Americans for end-of-war negotiations. So he ends up selecting this, you know, tiny little speck of coral out in the middle of nowhere called Midway. And on our side, we get wind of these developments via our code-breaking expertise, and that gives Admiral Nimitz barely enough time to scrape together the assets that he needs and put together a battle plan, get those carriers up off of Midway in time, and that's why we end up fighting a fleet action there.
Now, the thing that ultimately we had on our side, at least prior to the battle, is a guy named Joe Rochefort. And
yep.
Joe Rochefort was in charge of the code section of the U.S. Navy at Pearl Harbor, and they had been intercepting and partially reading Japanese naval code called JN-25.
Yep.
And in that code, they were able to deduce that the Japanese were looking to take Midway.
Yes.
Now, John, the big question is, and there are a lot of what-ifs, and Barrett and Tom, if you've got some ideas about this, by all means,
if I can interject a little
in,
thing
but,
of how lucky
yeah,
we were with Joe Rochefort.
Yeah.
I wasn't aware exactly of this until just recently, but the last actual Japanese message that we read was May 27th, just before the battle. Because May 28th, they changed the JN-25 code. They
That's
almost
right.
had it broken again by the end of June, but at the end of June, the code was changed again and was changed again in July. And from then on, all we ever did was traffic analysis. We did not read their mail, although the mythology is that we did the way that the British read the German traffic, but we didn't. So we were incredibly lucky to have been able to get what we got from reading the JN-25, because it stopped before the battle.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And
if we had not broken the code, what do you think would have happened? If
I think
we
they
had
would have.
Not broken, or if
yeah,
there had
you
been,
know.
If
so I'm the guy that wrote the book on the Battle of Midway, but I don't necessarily. You know, how much strategic impact would have losing the island of Midway really made? And I think there's, first of all, a pretty credible argument that even if the Japanese had won a carrier battle there, I don't know that they could have successfully invaded the place. They didn't really have much in the way of an amphibious doctrine. We've got 3,000 Marines backed by light armor sitting on those islands. I mean, good luck. So that's one thing. But even supposing they had taken Midway away from us, during the run-up to this operation, when Yamamoto was ramrodding this strategic conception of his down the throats of General GHQ up in Tokyo, the staff planners at Naval GHQ pointed out a number of things. And they said, well, you know, first of all, this island is out in the middle of nowhere. It's beyond the range of land-based air support from places like Wake. It is the size of a postage stamp, so you can't put a very large air group of your own onto this island. And it's, you know, close enough to Oahu that the Americans can get up there with heavy bombers like a B-17, and there's no room on this place to disperse our own aircraft. It's hideously exposed to submarine blockade, and I don't think, you know, we don't think we can keep it in supply anyway. So if he had managed to take that particular piece of real estate, I don't really know that it does him that much good. It gives him a toehold in the Hawaiian island chain, but it's going to be the sort of toehold that, you know, we can probably take back relatively easily. I mean, there's not a lot of strategic importance to Midway itself. Its strategic importance was ephemeral. What it was a magnet for a carrier battle. That was really the only reason he wanted to go there.
Exactly.
You know, we've kicked this around.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Go ahead,
Barrett.
Here. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we've kicked this around quite a bit in emails, especially on the Battle of Midway internet site. And honestly, I think that the Japanese were in the position of the proverbial Great Dane that chases the sports car.
Right.
What do you do when you catch it?
Yeah, exactly.
And John's really described the dilemma. If Japan seized Midway, they were probably not going to be able to keep it, even assuming that we would have re-seized it. And I suspect we would have, if for no other reason than to extend the range of our submarines, which was a leading reason for Midway throughout the war.
Mm-hmm.
But, John, you probably remember, this goes back at least a few years with John Lundstrom and I think Rich Frank. We have been tracking the historiography of Midway, which I think you'd agree is closely related to the mythology of the battle. And I guess it dates at least from Walter Lord in, I think, 1967 with his wonderful book, Incredible Victory.
Yeah.
But Midway... Midway has so often been portrayed as an all-or-nothing toss of the dice. And honestly, I'd be interested in your and Tom's perspective on this. I really think that had we lost the carrier battle at Midway, we still would have dropped anchor in Tokyo Bay, if not 1946, then definitely 1947.
Absolutely right. If we had lost Midway, the Japanese would have kept Midway at a maximum a year until the Essex-class ships came online the summer of 43, and we would have taken it back. And the thing people just really don't understand is there was no way in bloody anything that Japan was ever going to defeat the United States. The only thing they could ever do, and they didn't understand that they could never do it, was that if they bloodied our nose enough, we'd say, "Let me up, I've had enough." And Yamamoto's famous quote has now been determined to be apocryphal, that he didn't really say it, but it was true.
Right, the sleeping giant quote.
The sleeping giant. We would have smashed them if it had taken until 1950.
Yeah. Actually, let me look through my files here, because I found, I was going through the papers of Dallas Isom, just a couple months ago, who was another
another Midway author, actually, you know, sort of my competition in a sense, and he died a few years ago, and I actually got a hold of his son and was I've worked to get his father's research materials put down at the Nimitz Museum because there was some really interesting stuff in there, including his interviews with some of the hangar deck crewmen. But another thing that he had in his files, and I'm trying to fire it up right now, was a translated section of the Japanese War History series that was done, this translation was done by Admiral Edwin Layton, who was another one of the Midway codebreakers during the battle, and he must have done this translation sometime towards the end of his life. And if my acrobat would ever come up, there's a really interesting quote in there that Yamamoto opens the map exercises for the Battle of Midway planning. This is in early May of 1942. And he basically tells the assembled officers there that, you know, this new phase of operations, we are going to be going up against an alerted enemy. These are not going to be easy operations. And that you have to understand, guys, that we are up against an opponent that has a war-making potential that is 5 to 10 times our own, and that therefore the only way that we can prevail is to hit the enemy in, you know, his vital organs as rapidly as possible, over and over and over again. Yeah, here it is. The enemy's power in military armaments is from 5 to 10 times ours. Against this, we must increase the intensity of our attacks, hitting the enemy's vital places one after another. It is so really what he's pointing to there, I think, in modern military parlance, is we have to have a very high ops tempo against these guys. And the underlying subtext there is, as you alluded to, they're going for our morale. If they can hold us down, beat our noses bloody, we may just eventually say, you know what, screw it. I don't care about the Dutch East Indies. You can have the oil. The problem is, you know, if you go back to Pearl Harbor, the way that they started the war off with, you know, a surprise attack against Pearl Harbor, there is not going to be a negotiated settlement to this war. FDR has made it very clear, even in his, you know, his speech on December 8th, that we are fighting this thing down to the last bloody rowboat, and we are not going to settle for anything less than unconditional victory. So, you know, the Japanese, from a political standpoint, have dealt themselves a pretty crappy hand of cards, and they've got to play that. it's pretty unlikely that they're going to be able to pull, any sort of victory off.
One thing that I've always been impressed by, I remember Dick Best telling me this, and after him, any number of officers, of naval officers, but Best said that when he flew into Pearl Harbor the night of the attack, that he looked down at that and he swore vengeance against the Japanese.
There are a lot of people that felt that.
And
way.
In my book Fable 15, I have a quote from John Bridgers, who later led the attack that got the last Pearl Harbor carrier. And he said he arrived as a new ensign in January 1940, at the end of January 1942, and he could see the harbor. Nothing had changed; it was still a disaster. And he swore that if he could do anything, he would.
That had only been reinforced then by things like the Bataan Death March, because you start getting word of that in July and August of 1942. I mean, public opinion throughout this entire time frame is hardening against the Japanese.
Everybody in the Navy, when he flew back from sinking Zuikako, he said, "I thought to myself that the Navy's investment in me had finally been repaid."
Right. So, you know, back to your original question, I don't think that capturing Midway really is going to do anything for them. And in terms of prolonging the war, one of the things I talked about in this talk that I gave at the War College yesterday was one of the words that we throw out in conjunction with Midway is decisive. You know, everybody just, decisive battle. And what does that really mean, though, in the context of a war as big and sprawling as the Pacific War and World War II? And the mental image that we have around the word decisive or a decisive battle is that the outcome of the battle decides the outcome of the war. The loser loses the war. The winner of the battle is going to win the war. But I think, as Tom pointed out, even if we had lost at Midway, as horrible as that would have been, we are still going to win this war because of the disparity of the economic factors at work. And if you forward project and look at what happens, again, during the carrier building programs, by late 1944, you know, we put so many Essex class and Independence class carriers in the water that whether we lost two or three carriers at Midway, it's immaterial. I mean, we're just going to take this brand new Navy out, and we're going to find the Japanese carriers, and we are going to crush them. And that's, you know, second generation aircraft, much better anti-aircraft fire, blah 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 blah. It's game sometime in 1944, no matter what happens at Midway.
Yeah, I'm.
All right,
I'm,
gents, can three of you hang on for the station break? We're going to take a real quick break.
Okay.
And when we come back, Mike Greco is calling from Chicago, Illinois, to speak with us. So if you gents will just stand by for just a moment here. I want to take care of a little bit of business. This is Radio Free America on conservativenationmedia.com. We are talking with John Parshall, Tom Cleaver, and Barrett Tillman about the Battle of Midway. Now, one of the worst things that can happen to an American today is to be a victim of identity theft. If it does happen to you, it may take months or even longer to recover from it, if you can recover at all. Don't let it happen to you. Protect yourself in advance and sign up today with LifeLock. LifeLock is a lot more than just your standard credit monitoring service. LifeLock helps to protect your personal information using a combination of data surveillance techniques and outstanding member service 24/7, 365. There's really nothing that comes close to LifeLock. So to protect your identity with LifeLock and get 10% off their great service, go to conservativenationmedia.com and click on the LifeLock banner. The network may not cover all transactions and the scope may vary. That's conservativenationmedia.com. Click on the LifeLock banner. You will be very glad you did, and you will be glad that you stuck around to hear more with John Parshall, Tom Cleaver, and Barrett Tillman on the Battle of Midway, so don't go away.
Americans have known Tennessee as the volunteer state since the War of 1812. Now, Tennessee is leading the way in another major conflict. The war to keep America's identity, values, and freedoms intact. Even if you've never walked in Memphis or hiked the Blue Ridge Mountains, if you respect traditional American values, you should know about the Tennessee Action Council. Tennessee Action Council fights to preserve American values, defend our way of life, and protect the U.S. Constitution. This isn't just Tennessee's battle. It affects every American who loves our country and wants to pass the real America, unstained by progressive liberalism, along to future generations. No matter where you are in this magnificent country of ours, Tennessee Action Council is on your side and on America's side. Go to TN4Action.com. That's TN, the number 4, Action.com to volunteer for Tennessee and America. That's TN, the number 4, Action.com to stand for America now.
Molon LeBay Challenge Coins and Wares. Similar to challenge coins used by various military units, these MLCCW coins are ideal for anyone that champions the right to keep and bear arms by highlighting the Second Amendment and the Greek phrase Molon LeVay, which translated means come and take them. Come check out our pro-freedom, pro-liberty, and pro-Second Amendment coins and shirts at MLCCW.com. That's MLCCW.com.
Hi, this is Michael Behrman, inviting you to join me every Sunday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central on The Michael Behrman Show.
Hit them!
Right here on conservativenationmedia.com.
And it's still the wrong lever. You're listening to Duke Brooks on conservativenationradio.org.
I am he as you are, he as you
I just cannot get enough Beatles. Welcome back, everybody. Duke Brooks here on Radio Free America, the Wednesday, June 4th, 2014 edition. And I am joined by authors and World War II experts, Barrett Tillman, who is going to tell us shortly about the key airplane at the Battle of Midway. Today is the 72nd anniversary. Barrett has written hundreds of books, thousands of magazine articles. You probably know him from TV on various history and military history channel shows. I'm also joined by John Parshall, the writer of Shattered Sword, The Untold Story of the Battle of Midway, and John is widely regarded as being the foremost expert on the battle alive today. And Tom Cleaver, Hollywood scriptwriter from way back, who now writes about military history. His most recent book is called The Fabled 15, about Air Group 15. And now from Chicago, Illinois, Mike Greco is on the line with us. Mike, did you have some questions or observations to make of our panel?
Well, first of all, I want to make sure, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes,
okay,
I can.
Good. First of all, it's an honor to be on the phone with you, gentlemen. I feel like a little kid. I'm 55 years old, and it's quite an honor to be on the phone with the experts. I started researching and reading about this when I was like 15 years old, and there wasn't much information to be found out there, and now it's just amazing to me, you know, through the books, everything else, what's been released, what's been, you know, declassified over the years. It's very impressive. It seems like every time I go and read on the web or look at a book, there's something new. It's very exciting. But my question to any of you is, why is this subject not dealt with in a more in-depth manner than a 1 or a 2 hour special? Why can't there be a 3 hour or a 5 hour or a 6 hour type Ken Burns documentary on this? Because it's so important.
That is a good question.
I can answer that as somebody who works in that business. Unfortunately, those of us who would tune into it are probably not a big enough audience for that, or at least we're not a big enough audience to do it the way that you would like to see it done and I would like to see it done as far as a budget to do it right. This is one reason why a lot of the military shows you see on television, if you look at them, they end up, they're pretty obviously fairly done on a fairly tight budget. And that's because the people who are making them don't get much money because the people who are going to show them don't think they're going to have much audience. I would love to see them all be disproven, but it's
the
kind of argument
on this.
I have made many times and
yes.
Lost every time.
I mean, you can make the argument from intelligence. You can make the argument from the Hail Mary aspect, which everyone likes to argue.
Everything.
You can make
you're
decision-making
right about
process.
You're entirely right about every point. Absolutely. I wish that I could make those points and win, but I lost.
there has been rumors afoot. I know there are more than rumors, actually, that there was a Midway movie in the works, but I think it has kind of been shelved temporarily. I know this because
I know that for a fact, John.
Yeah,
I know that for a fact.
Yeah, I had Jim Hornfisher kind of, he's my agent, put my name in as a potential historical advisor, and this project was going to be done by the same group that had done Band of Brothers and the Pacific, and they turned me down because they were going to probably use the same historical advising crew, Hugh Ambrose and maybe my friend Richard Frank as well, you know, and I don't begrudge people that. Do I know more about Midway than Hugh Ambrose? Yeah, I do. But, you know, if you're a producer, you also want to go to someone who is a known commodity and who you know you're going to get a result from. So, but I haven't heard anything about that project
for
a while.
At one point, there was the Pacific was going to be a bigger canvas than it turned out to be, and it was going to include the naval side of the equation. At one point, John Bridger's son, told me that he had been contacted by the people who were working on the show to to buy his father's rights because his father had been on the Yorktown at Midway, and they were going to include him in the story and try and get a wider thing to it. Which finally they found that they'd gone as wide as they could.
Right.
There is a continual rumor out here that the last thing that they want to do is something about a Band of Brothers story involving naval aviation, which would make me really happy if they would, if they are listening to
folks. Yeah.
Well, if it helps, I can provide a little bit of background on the original concept for the Pacific. It was going to include naval aviation, and I dealt with Hugh over a period of months on that. And the problem was that it was not possible at that time, and this would have been, late 90s or thereabouts, mid to late 90s. But by that time, there were no longer enough naval aviator veterans who had participated both in Midway, the Guadalcanal campaign, and the fast carriers. So you wouldn't have the same type of on-screen presence with the genuine veterans alternating with the actors.
Sure.
And at that point, the concept obviously focused entirely on the Mud Marines.
Right.
Well, respectfully, if we could sit here and do... Yeah, I'm still with you. I have a couple more things I'd like to ask you about. I recently read an article, or I don't know if it was online, where they were discussing the communication that was sent to Target AF.
Yeah.
And they said it was sent over a cable line under the ocean.
That's right.
I was always under the impression that it was sent via courier in a sealed envelope.
No.
Any of you know anything more about this?
No, it was sent by cable.
Oh, it was?
Yeah,
okay.
There was a secure communications cable that ran between Oahu and Midway, and that's what they used.
Okay. That's the first time I'd heard that, guys.
John, correct me, but my understanding is that AF is short of water was not intended to for the Japanese. It was meant to convince DC that Rochefort was reading it right.
That's correct.
You
yeah, there was a big battle going on between the Pacific Code Breakers and Op 20G, which is back in D.C., which was the cryptographic unit that was run by the Redmond brothers. And they were telling King that, no, we think the next Japanese offensive is going to happen down in the South Pacific. And there were certainly reasons backing that up. I mean, obviously, we just fought a carrier battle down there. It's reasonable to assume that the Japanese would be interested in attacking down there. And indeed, they were. I mean, there were follow-up operations that were aimed at places like Fiji and Samoa that were supposed to go down after Midway. So, yeah, that whole message was basically to convince Washington that, yeah, Hypo knows what they're talking about here. And it was a mark of Nimitz's faith in his code breakers that, he was willing to go along with something like that.
Gents, I want to bring in Stan Bittman, who is calling from Frisco, Texas, north of Dallas. Stan, welcome aboard, and say hello to Barrett and John and Tom and Mike from Chicago.
Well, thank you. Hey, it's a privilege. I've read you guys' books. I've watched you on TV, and it's a real treat to get to talk to you. The question I have is, over the years, I've played a number of simulations, board simulations, computer simulations of the Battle of Midway, and the one thing that I've always wondered is, at the time, what kind of a grasp did Admiral Nimitz have of the, I don't want to say superiority, but of the proficiency of the Japanese naval air arm?
I think he was extremely cognizant of that fact. He had a lot of professional respect for the Japanese, but I think that was colored as well by his own respect for his own pilots. And one of the sort of little vignettes that doesn't often get advertised here,
Intel said that the Japanese could bring as many as 5 carriers to the battle. And in fact, they probably should have, you know, if they could have scraped together some sort of a composite air group for Zuikaku, they could have sent her along.
Right.
And Nimitz was willing to fight that battle even if Yorktown had not been returned to service. So he was willing to go 2-on-5 for that particular fight. That gives you an indication of just how aggressive he was. Of course, he was hoping to get better results from his submarines and his organic air power on Midway in terms of attriting that carrier force before he had to commit his own carriers to battle. But that tells you something about his faith in his own aviators. I think he respected the Japanese, but he also knew that he had guys like, you know, Dick Best and McCluskey and Dusty Cleese and people like that, that, you know, these guys could put a bomb where it needed to go.
It just seems like given the superior ranges of the Japanese naval aircraft and, again, the proficiency of these guys at the time, that it's always made me wonder how much Admiral Nimitz really appreciated that, and also the fact that that patchwork of airplanes that were on Midway, surely he expected more out than what he got out of those.
Yeah.
And that also made me wonder, did he really appreciate what the heck he was up against?
Yeah, that is a good question. And to an extent, I think the superior range of Japanese aircraft is somewhat overstated. And Barrett, you can jump in on that one if you have an opinion on that too. I mean, yes, they were longer range, but it wasn't like, you know, orders of magnitude. It was like maybe 25 to 50 miles effectively.
Right.
Yeah, I would say generally that's true with the exception.
Zero was the only one that was particularly long range in comparison
right.
to...
But,
yeah,
you know, in terms of the proficiency of the pilots, yeah, that's certainly something you have to take into consideration. And, you know, one of the points I made in the talk yesterday, I personally think that the single most crucial tactical moment in the entire battle is when Dick Best realizes that,
yeah,
you know, Kaga is about to get a double-barreled helping of goodness here, and Akagi is getting off scot-free. And, you know, if Akagi gets off the hook, this could potentially be a very bad thing, because standing over on Akagi right now is Lieutenant Commander Murata Shigeharu, who is, you know, universally acknowledged as the
he's
best
Mr.
torpedo guy in the Imperial Fleet, and his squadron is 100% Pearl Harbor vets. These are the guys that devastated Battleship Row. You know, if those cats get added into Hiryu's dive bombers going out at 11 o'clock and looking for Yorktown, heaven help her. It was very important to take those guys out right then and there, because that was a highly proficient squadron. You did not want them to be up in the air along with Hiryu's equally proficient dive bomber squadron under Kobayashi. So,
I agree. I've always felt like Dick Best ran a very close second to Wade McCluskey in terms of decision-making, individual initiative, having
an
impact on the battle.
If you had talked to Dick Best, you might reverse that.
That's an interesting point. You know,
McCluskey actually...
I heard he was a very humble guy.
Dick Best was not happy that McCluskey screwed up his dive, I can tell you that much. And
also, Best told me that McCluskey blew it about not turning when he should have, and Best had it right there on his plotting board that we're supposed to turn here, but he had to maintain radio silence, and he couldn't give himself enough speed advantage to come up and give him a hand wave. And he said, and just by chance, McCluskey made the right turn, and then ran across that destroyer,
right?
Best was always convinced that had they made the turn where they were supposed to, that they would have arrived over the Japanese fleet at the same time as the torpedo bombers. They might have protected them.
Oh, interesting! I never knew that.
And then of course the problem for McCluskey was he was a fighter pilot.
Exactly.
He had just fleeted up to CAG, and he had no knowledge of dive bomber strategy, and he didn't realize that BS-6 was supposed to fly to the far carrier, so that they were the lead plane, they were to go to the far target, while BB-6, being the near, being the rear, would go to the near target, and then they would make a simultaneous dive.
Right.
And you know, Bess was sitting there waving his wings. He said he was doing 30-degree banks, you know, to convince his two guys to stay with him, and
Weber and Kroger,
Kroger and Weber. Sorry, I'm just looking.
Weber,
Kroger and Weber.
Fred Weber.
And then by chance, by luck, it was probably the single most effective dive bombing attack made by anybody in the war, because he hit the ship, and they near missed it close enough that you know, there was the equivalent of torpedo hits.
Yeah, no, that second near miss is actually, in some ways, it's not more critical, but it guarantees that you are not going to tow Akagi out of there, because you've damaged her rudder. And,
right.
You know, I don't know if you've ever tried dragging a 50,000-ton ship, you know, by the stern with its rudders askew, but, you know, that just wasn't going to happen. Yeah, I kind of look at those two guys and think that they're sort of the two sides of the same coin. I give McCluskey props for having gotten those two squadrons where they needed to be. And okay, granted,
well,
maybe
he did better than Ring, who went out
and then executed
the standard maneuver of go to the nearest land.
Well, that leads me to my second question. I wanted to hear you guys' commentary on the flight to nowhere.
Well, there's a lot of controversy over that even now. I mean, there are still a couple of surviving Midway aviators who claim that they don't buy John Lundstrom's interpretation that the flight to nowhere was basically steering 270 heading, you know, due west. The other thing that Lundstrom believes, and I think he's probably right, is that Mitcher, who was the commander of the Hornet, basically was not happy to be operating underneath Spruance, who had no carrier experience. And again, American intel is telling them that the Japanese are probably operating their carriers in two carrier task forces. And so there's this mythical second carrier task force that may be out there someplace. And I think what Lundstrom believes, and I tend to agree, is that Mitcher thought to himself, well, I'm going to go get that task force. And that's why he sent Ring off due west looking for that.
There's also lots of rumors that afterwards he did everything he could to get his fingerprints off of that one. Right?
Absolutely. Well, his performance was terrible, and I mean the only thing I think that saved Mitcher was the fact that he'd already been vetted to flag rank. Otherwise, I think he'd be counting trees someplace.
John, you're absolutely right. A friend of mine, Jigdog Ramage, later war SBD pilot, knew. I'm drawing a blank. One of Mitcher's contemporaries, and that admiral said that as of June 4th, 1942, Mark Mitcher was convinced that his career was over, except he had already been pre-selected for a rear admiral.
Right.
And at that point, you start to see the political machinations, because he had brought along, as I recall, Stanhope Ring, the air group commander, and Sam Mitchell, the fighter squadron commander, who were Bureau of Aeronautics DC dweebs, cronies of his,
right.
Neither of whom were technically proficient in their airplanes, and neither of whom were very good leaders. And here you have Stanhope Ring is the only commander of any group that any air group that or organization that sought the Japanese carriers, that failed to find them. He ran all his fighters out of gas. Two of the pilots drowned.
That was really bad.
And he got a Navy Cross, and he retired with 3 stars. So what does that say about the institution of the U.S.
Navy? You know, when you graduate number one in your class at Canoe U, it will stick with you.
But I will say, back to the original question, I remain convinced that the air group, Hornets air group, flew due west. And the litmus test for me, I don't care what any of these veterans say, and I hate to be a jerk about that. Thank you very much for your service. But the fact that Waldron comes in with VT-8 and makes his attack out of the north-northeast against, or the east-northeast, I should say, against Kido Butai, argues very strongly that he peeled away from the Hornet Air Group to the left, i.e. to the southwest, and
yes.
then made his way right down to Kita-Butai. And the Japanese records are in no conflict whatsoever regarding the direction that those American airplanes came in and attacked them. So that, to me, is, you know, the conflicting American aviator accounts are, to me, a he said, she said kind of deal. And it's the Japanese that I think have the trump card here in terms of the interpretation. That's how
I agree. You bet.
Duke has got something for us. What?
I was just going to say, today I happened to go over to the Enterprise website, and I was reading Dick Best's after-action report for the battle.
Uh-huh.
And it's really interesting. I mean, it's very dry, but he sits there and exactly. And this is something a lot of people don't remember. I remember the first time I met him, looking at a photograph of VB-6 on his wall, and him making the comment that two-thirds of those young men were dead 24 hours after that photograph was taken.
Right.
And he puts it in his report, summarizing, 5 planes out of 15 returned. The personnel of 4 other planes were rescued. The personnel of 6 planes are unaccounted for. One of the 5 planes which returned, 6B-16, was so badly damaged by shrapnel and machine gun fire that it could not be flown in subsequent attacks.
Same thing happened to their torpedo group, too. I mean,
yeah.
14 planes in, 5 came home, and one of them was junk.
Right.
So, boy.
But, you know, that's a stunning statistic to think of.
Yeah.
We've got about 1 minute until the break at the top of the hour. If I could just make one or two quick observations for... I know that there are a lot of people listening who are not really students of the Battle of Midway or maybe even not of the U.S. Navy World War II, but when we talk about these squadrons such as VB-6 or VT-8,
right.
All U.S. Navy airplane squadrons that were flying airplanes as opposed to blimps, the letter V, which my dad told me stood for heavier than air, as opposed to an L squadron, which would have been blimps. But the next letter tells you basically what kind of squadron it was. F is a fighter, T are torpedo bombers, and SB or B are scout bombers or dive bombers.
Right.
And... I just love the way the Navy designated things. Just can you stand by with me? We're going to take a break now at the top of the hour, get some news from the Talk Radio News Service, Keeley Sullivan in Washington, and then we will be right back with John Parshall, Tom Cleaver, and Barrett Tillman on this 72nd anniversary of the Battle of Midway here on conservativemedia.com. Okay. All righty. Talk Radio News Service coming up at the top of the hour. Don't go away.
Here's the news coming to you every hour on the hour. The weather's fine, but there may be a meteor shower.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
Service, I'm Keeley Sullivan. President Obama met President-elect Petro Poroshenko this morning and approved $5 million in body armor, night vision goggles, and communications equipment for the Ukraine's military. President Obama also said he would offer U.S. support for the Ukrainian economy if Russian gas supplies are cut this winter. According to the Federal Election Commission, election financial reports released in 2013 say that 1,086 congressional candidates have raised $610.5 million dollars and spent $320.7 million that year. FEC concluded that congressional candidates will have $474.9 million to spend in the upcoming 2014 election. Student debt is attracting federal attention after Richard Vedder, director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity, testified today to the Senate Budget Committee. According to Vedder, surveys conducted in 2012 show that college tuition is rising annually at a rate of 3.8%. Keeley Sullivan, Washington.
What does it take to be the leader in production systems technology? To be the one company that solves production problems at any plant, for any product, and with any technology? It takes a 30-year record of success. It takes total mastery of complex technologies with a history of delivering success every time, without fail. Only one company can claim that high ground in manufacturing line optimization, data automation, and systems integration, and that's Philadelphia Control Systems. In factories worldwide, Philadelphia Control Systems programs, software, and engineering solutions deliver optimal performance and output flow with a record that can't be matched. Any plant, any product, any technology. Philadelphia Control Systems, the leader in production automation since 1982. 800-335-9811. PCSforAutomation.com. That's PCS, the number 4, automation.com.
Been looking for an online gathering place? You know, a familiar screen, does everything you're used to, except give you grief for being a conservative? You've got to try the Tea Party community. At TPC, you'll know how everything works from the very first minute, and you'll probably find a lot of friends who are already there. Organize, communicate, share ideas, upcoming events, pictures, and videos. The Tea Party community connects and empowers like-minded, politically conservative people like you. Sign up today at teapartycommunity.com.
Hi, this is Dave Vance, your host for Inside Tennessee on ConservativeNationMedia.com. Inside Tennessee is moving to Tuesday nights beginning on May 6th. Tune in and join the conversation with some of Tennessee's most conservative and constitutionally minded activists, experts, politicians, and average citizens that are fed up and making a stand. That's Inside Tennessee, Tuesday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Central on ConservativeNationMedia.com, where America always wins.
Hi, welcome back. This is Radio Free America on ConservativeNationMedia.com, the Wednesday, June 4th edition, and today is the 72nd anniversary of the Battle of Midway, and I am joined by author and TV celebrities Barrett Tillman, John Parshall, and Tom Cleaver.
Celebrity.
All three have written... Celebrity, yeah, that's right, John. Yeah, that's you, pal. Okay.
Talking head, you know. Oh, man.
I think Mike Greco is still with us from Chicago, Illinois. Let's back up just a moment and to make sure that people, and obviously a lot of people listen to this program on podcast, I want to make sure people understand basically the situation at Midway. Midway, two tiny little islands surrounded by a coral reef about 1,500 miles west-northwest, way out in the Pacific. It's like the next to last island in the Hawaiian chain, way out there. And the Japanese are coming with four aircraft carriers, troop transports, battleships, all that stuff. And they're trying to take Midway Island from us. We had broken their code, and we had sent three aircraft carriers waiting in silent ambush up there to the northeast of Midway. And the first day of the battle, June 3rd, the United States sent out B-17s and I think A-26s to try to even a PBY with a torpedo shackled onto it.
Yep.
To go out and try to get the Japanese. And the next morning, Japan's aircraft carriers attack Midway Island itself.
Yep.
And John, maybe you could pick it up from there, because the information that came back to Japan during and after that first wave air attack against Midway. That information, some was late, some of it was, I mean, this was Japan's real downfall in the battle.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on here. Nagumo being the carrier group commander, the Japanese commander at the scene, has a potentially bad situation in that he's got to knock Midway out of business relatively quickly because they're intending on invading the place and turning it into a fighter base relatively quickly. And yet, as it turns out, you know, something we learned during the course of the war, airfields are pretty resilient targets. And so he sends off a strike of 108 aircraft during the morning, and they plaster Midway pretty well. But it's impossible in the course of one strike to not only crater the airfield but also knock out the anti-aircraft defenses that are there, let alone the shore defense batteries that are going to need to be nullified if an invasion is going to go forward. So the strike commander from that force radios back at 0700 a very terse little message. And in code, it's just kawa, 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 0700. And if you look it up in the code book, the translation is there's a need for a second strike. Now, at this point, Admiral Nagumo has got seven aircraft that have been out sort of searching his eastern flank and to make sure that there aren't any unwelcome visitors out there in terms of an American naval force. And when that message rolls in at 0700 from his strike planes, he hasn't heard anything from those scouting aircraft. And so he considers the situation for a little bit. And then at 0715, he issues orders to his carriers to take the remaining half of their strike planes, which have been held in reserve as an anti-ship strike force, and to rearm those planes with land attack weapons so that they can then be committed for a second strike against Midway. This really only affects the torpedo planes, which are in Carrier Division 1, which is Kaga and Akagi, so there's a lot of activity going on in the hangar decks of those two ships at this time. Lo and behold, 30 minutes after he gives that rearm order, Tone's number 4 scouting plane radios in with a message saying, there's an American task force out here. And initially he doesn't say that there's a carrier with it, but as numerous other authors have pointed out, you know, there was no business in having an American naval force in that location if it didn't have an aircraft carrier in it. And so Nagumo was within his rights to assume that it did. Nagumo immediately reverses his rearming order and says, hold it, put the torpedoes back on those torpedo planes again. And so now there's a lot of scrambling going on in the hangar decks at this time. And that, yeah, at this point, Nagumo now finds himself in a situation where he's just really behind the eight ball. He's been late in getting the intelligence that he needs, and those aircraft that he used to hit Midway are going to come back relatively shortly. He's going to need to bring those down, and he's got half-armed aircraft. Can he get a counterstrike against the Americans in? You know, there's just a lot of imponderables there that he's got to judge. And you know, from this time forward, he's never able to get his strike planes up on his flight deck to counterattack against us. There, that's kind of a long-winded explanation.
Well, that was really the reason that Japan lost that battle, because the Americans were busily trying to attack them while they were essentially engaged in housekeeping. But housekeeping for all the wrong reasons.
The one thing that this shows is that the Japanese did not do in their development of naval aviation pre-war was come up with the idea of the scout bomber, and since they had their scouts being float planes that could do nothing but scout,
right.
And had they had the airplane that Barrett's going to talk about, the equivalent of a Dauntless, and they had a search capability that had a limited strike capability, their guy could have found the carriers and done what our guy would have been ordered to do. Would have been his policy would have been to get the attack, to get the information as once he knew that his fleet had the information, was to make an attack on the enemy carrier, put a hole in the deck. And had they held
fairness,
deck of one of those carriers, that
frequently did not work.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's one instance of that really in a later battle where they, you know, the scout actually finds the carrier and puts a hole in Zuiho's flight deck, but you know, typically that didn't work out real well because carriers were big, gnarly targets, and you needed a full squadron of planes in many instances to take them out.
But had they had the capability, you know, it might have hit one of the carriers and could have changed things.
Yeah, it's possible.
That's a major. But you know, the thing was that they didn't come up with the concept to begin with, so it's an entirely moot point.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question or make
Japanese
an observation?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Mike. Go ahead, Mike.
It's Mike Greco again. Everything you said is wonderful. The one thing that I, in reading the books, that you know, your book, everything else, the one thing that you pointed out that I find fascinating is the fact that the Japanese had discovered fire suppression and that sort of thing. And you didn't bring that up, but that's a big part of it too, isn't it, filling the lines with CO2?
Yeah.
Like we
know, the Japanese didn't have any of that. Their damage control was lamentably bad. One of the things that I think is so fascinating about the early period of the war is how quickly the U.S. Navy is evolving during this time. And it's remarkably clarifying when you're getting your butt kicked, you know, that you need to change your game. And you know, one of the things that we're really changing rapidly is how we deal with damage control. You know, how to keep your ship afloat even if it's been badly damaged. And you know, the whole business of flooding CO2 or flooding fuel lines with CO2 had just been developed in the last month. There was a guy on board the Yorktown, one of the fuel officers there, who had watched the Lexington during that battle basically burn to the waterline as a result of an avgas fire, and he came up with this notion, you know, what if we put CO2 in our lines? And what's fascinating here is you've got a junior officer who comes up with a bright idea, and he brings it up to the damage control officer, hey, can I try this? And the DCO is like, well, yeah, let's give it a whirl, because, man, that was ugly what happened to the Lexington. And so by the time Yorktown shows up to Midway, less than a month later, they've implemented this brand new practice, and it saves the ship. You know, Kobayashi's dive bomber attack at around noon would have knocked Midway or Yorktown on her keister had they not drained her fuel lines and put CO2 in them to keep them from catching on fire. So, you know, we were making enormous strides during this time, trying to figure out ways to innovate and improve. And unfortunately, the Japanese, you know, if you're on the side that's winning, you don't have as much of an impetus to change your playbook up, and it really starts to bite them in the butt.
Well,
John, as you mentioned in your book, in 1940, for every car in Japan, there were 60 in the United States.
I think it was 80, actually. Yeah. It's
okay. All right. Fair enough.
Yeah.
We had a tremendous, and have for a very long time, a tremendous national culture of messing around with mechanical things.
Yes.
Generally started by young men at a fairly young age with cars or lawnmower, anything else.
Well, and
a lot of
this is driven by the Depression, of course, too. If you were a young man, you know, you didn't have enough money to take your car to a garage. You had to figure out how to repair it yourself. And so, yeah, we did have that culture. And I sort of jump in on you. I think the point you're probably leading to, though, is that we have a tremendous advantage then in terms of training, you know, everything from aircraft mechanics to damage control officers to, you know, radio repair technicians, and it's absolutely true. A much bigger pool of manpower to draw those sorts of individuals for, whereas with the Japanese, yes, their hangar crewmen were extremely competent at Midway, but these were individuals that had had to be trained over the course of years to attain that competency. And once, you know, some of those guys were gone, and they lost a lot of them at Midway, it's pretty difficult to, you know, find new recruits in Japan that have got the requisite level of mechanical knowledge.
Which certainly shows up at Philippine Sea 2 years later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Mike, you have something else for us?
Yeah, I actually had something else I wanted to ask you about. The Japanese, you know, I've read this in a few of the books and, you know, just general opinion. Some people have called them a little bit arrogant, thinking that we didn't present a challenge. And you talked about those search planes.
Yeah.
Did they have the possibility to have had more search planes and they just decided they didn't need them? I mean, we were out there searching like there was no tomorrow, right?
Well, and actually, I very much do not want to steal the thunder from my co-author, Tony Tully.
Okay.
Tony and a guy that he's been working with, a gentleman named Liu Yu, who is a Chinese national. He's actually over here in the States as a grad student, but he's very, very deep into the Japanese Navy and is able to read their official histories. Tony and Liu are working on a new article, and I've seen some preliminary drafts of it. It's very interesting. And what they point out is that if you look at the body of 1941 and 1942 air searches, Midway really isn't all that bad. In fact, it's better than a lot of the searches that the Japanese had used to that point. And frankly, it's better than a lot of the American searches that had been used, even, you know, during some of the carrier raids against places like Marcus and Wochi and those places that had occurred in February and March. What that says is that both navies at this point were still really trying to figure out how to play the aircraft carrier game. And a lot of people's air searches were very perfunctory in nature and not at all thorough. The reason that there's a lot of emphasis on the Japanese search pattern at Midway, I mean, which in a nutshell, the Japanese were trying to search an area of ocean the size of Sweden with seven airplanes, and, you know, not too surprisingly, it's pretty difficult to do that. But you know, nobody was doing very extensive searches there. But what ends up happening is after the war, guys like Fuchida and Genda try to point the finger of blame at the search pattern as being one of the reasons that the Japanese lost. And the Americans pick up on that theme, too. Richard Bates, in his analysis for the U.S. Naval War College in 1948, very much picks up on that theme. It sounds nice in retrospect, but as I think Tony and Liu are going to demonstrate, it really doesn't hold water in terms of the current, the then current methodology for doing searches. So there you have it, sneak preview of an article that I hope will end up in the Naval War College Review in the not too distant future.
You know, there's two other aspects of the search I'd like to touch upon briefly. Number one, from the American side, we had the tremendous advantage of long-range land-based patrol planes, PBYs, and to an extent, B-17s. And,
yes,
of course, the Japanese did not have that. Secondarily, I think that you can probably make a case from the Imperial Navy's perspective of the institutional emphasis on the offensive. And
yes,
I've always suspected, without being able to read the primary sources, that the Japanese decided to put most of their search eggs in the VOS, the cruiser and battleship-based basket, in order to maximize the strike potential off the carriers.
Oh, that's
exactly right. Exactly.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. No question of it. You've got good questions, Mike, just by the way, and our other caller as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, this has been fun.
Yeah, I don't know where Stan went, but, you know, I hope that he was able to learn what he wanted to learn. So we have a situation going on northwest of Midway where the Japanese are trying to rearm their airplanes. They're trying to recover the strike airplanes at the same time Japanese aircraft carriers are built differently than American aircraft carriers. The hangar decks are not basically open to the weather like ours were.
Or could be, yeah,
and,
right.
Or could be, yeah. And at this moment, we have a couple of torpedo squadrons. One of them was Torpedo 6, I believe, and that would have been from the Enterprise. Am I correct on that?
The first
yes,
one to attack
right.
is VT-8, Torpedo 8 from the Hornet. And that
okay,
that attack Hornet. Rolls in. So, yeah, basically what ends up happening is Nagumo makes the decision, I'm not going to put up a quickie little counterstrike with just my dive bombers. I'm going to wait until I've got all my torpedo planes rearmed, and I'm going to go out with the full meal deal. So having made that decision, he then says, I'm going to bring down my morning strike package from Midway. I'm going to recover them. And that starts happening at about 08:30. That evolution takes until 09:10 or 09:15 or thereabouts. So full 45 minutes, right? As soon as those planes come down, you got to think that Nagumo is looking for an opportunity to put up a counterstrike. But literally no sooner have those last planes landed on his flight deck than lo and behold, here comes Torpedo Squadron 8, which is annihilated in the course of the next 17 to 20 minutes. 15 planes in, 15 out of 15 shot. Yes, yeah, it's horrific. You know, and one guy left alive in the water. As soon as that ends up wrapping up, lo and behold, VT-6 from Enterprise rolls in from the south and launches a similar attack. Nagumo is turning tail and running from both of these formations because it chops, you know, 25 knots off the attack speed of those enemy planes and gives his cap just that much more opportunity to chew these guys up. So VT-6 comes in from 0940 to about 10 o'clock. They, too, are just clobbered. Most of their planes are shot down, and not a blessed thing to show for it in terms of hits against the enemy. Now, the conventional interpretation of those two attacks has always been that, well, you know, their sacrifice was tragic, but what they did is they dragged the Japanese Zeros down to sea level, and that sort of paved the way for the American dive bombers to come in and do their thing a little bit later, which is a lovely story, but it's also nonsense because the Zero can climb from sea level to 15,000 feet in about 5 minutes flat. So, you know, you do the math. VT-8 is completely annihilated by 0937 or so. VT-6 is driven out of the area by 10 o'clock. Those American dive bombers aren't going to roll in until 10:20. You know, most of those Zeros were able to regain altitude.
What were the Japanese doing? What after the torpedo attacks, what was the Japanese Combat Air Patrol doing?
That's
an interesting question because Best's after-action report states no fighter opposition was encountered prior to pullouts from the dives.
That's right. Well,
they
hear me out.
They were all hit
because
after,
there
at
is
low
a,
level.
There is a pullout. Third torpedo attack, and that is what ends up happening now. So at around 10 o'clock, Kitobutai has now been sighted by two separate formations of aircraft. Coming up from the southwest, you've got Enterprise's two squadrons of dive bombers who are famously following that destroyer back to the main Japanese fleet. And there's actually an interesting piece of new scholarship on that destroyer. And then in from the southeast, you have Yorktown's package, which is a squadron of dive bombers, a squadron of torpedo planes, and six Wildcat fighters that are riding herd on those torpedo planes. The Japanese don't see the dive bombers. This is in the days before radar. And there's broken cloud cover. They don't see them. What they do see is Torpedo Squadron 3 coming in right against the Hiryu. And so very quickly, that whole southeast threat vector just fills full of Zeros, which first are prying those six Wildcats off the top of VT-3 and then are starting to, you know, assassinate the torpedo squadron. So that is the attack where those Zeros end up first at medium altitude and then down lower as they're chewing up VT-3. So if you want to talk about torpedo planes that end up distorting the Japanese Combat Air Patrol, VT-3 is the attack that really makes that happen.
From the Yorktown.
You know, there's a corollary, and I have no idea if the information exists, John. You, above all, would know. Assuming that the zero CAP from the first two torpedo attacks had been able to climb to altitude to intercept the inbound SBDs, I wonder how much ammunition those zeros retained at that point.
Oh, no, that's a very good point. And, in fact, if you look at the sequence of events, you know, VT-8, again, is completely destroyed by the Combat Air Patrol. VT-6, which attacked under similarly disadvantageous circumstances, loses 9 of its 14 aircraft, which obviously is a very bad day at the office, but they were not annihilated. And we know that one of the reasons for that is that some of the Japanese fighters were running out of cannon ammo. Their 20-millimeter cannons only had 60 rounds per barrel.
Yeah.
So I think you're absolutely right that, yeah, a lot of those fighters, even if they've gotten back to altitude, would have been pretty low on 20-millimeter ammo, and it's pretty darn difficult to bring down a plane like a Dauntless with just a pair of twin 7.7-millimeter machine guns, which is the other armament in a Zero.
Yeah.
Likewise, you know, the total head count of those three dive bomber squadrons coming in is, I don't know, 45 planes or something like that?
47, I think.
Okay,
yeah.
You know, the Japanese didn't even have that many Zeros in the air, and the SBD Dauntless is a prickly little target, particularly when it's in a tight, packed-up formation like that, as Saburo Sakai found much to his dismay. You know, making rear attacks on a group of Dauntlesses gets you a face full of lead. I can imagine that the Japanese Combat Air Patrol would have, you know, been able to disrupt those dive bomber attacks to a degree. But once a set of dive bombers gets relatively close to its target, it's almost impossible to really disrupt them. And we see evidence of that in the attacks against Hiryu later in the afternoon. You know, and they fought just tooth and nail. There the CAP actually was alerted, and they went after the incoming American dive bombers, and they were, you know, pulling out all the stops against these guys. And they did shoot a couple of them down, but, you know, they didn't really stop. It did not stop us from putting four bombs into Hiryu and dooming her. So do I think that the torpedo planes, particularly VT-3, had an impact, a negative impact on the CAF? Yeah, I absolutely do. But I don't necessarily think that it would have thwarted our dive bomber attack, certainly not coming in from multiple directions as it was. So there you have it.
Well, the Japanese paid a very serious price for, I guess, Admiral Nagumo's decision concerning the returning airplanes message from Midway and the late information from that scout, number 4. John, does anybody know the name of the pilot of the Tone Cruiser Scout number 4?
Oh, sure, yeah. His name is Amari. And none of that three-plane crew ended up surviving the war. Amari was killed, I believe, in the Philippines, and his two backseaters were killed either at Okinawa or something like that. But it would have been fascinating to have had a chance to interview those guys and see what was going on there. One of the points that I think Tony and Lou are going to make in this next article of theirs is that, you know, there's a lot of finger-pointing that goes on both against Nagumo and against Tone number 4, and I think a lot of it is fairly unwarranted, to be honest with you. Nagumo, how do I put this? We're in a stage of carrier warfare that is very much wild, wild west, and the playbooks that these guys had to use were very thin in a lot of respects, and so Nagumo makes decisions during that battle which were coherent from the standpoint of the doctrinal playbook that he had in his hand. Could he have potentially gotten a counterstrike in with his dive bombers? Yeah, maybe, but, you know, during this entire time, you know, he's under attack by VT-8 and VT-6. I don't know if you've ever tried spotting an aircraft on a flight deck that's, you know, tilting 15, 20 degrees as we're violently maneuvering the ship, but it can't have been fun, you know, and they opted not to do that. Likewise, you know, think about the exercise of trying to put a strike up on these flight decks. If you were under any sort of a strafing attack, I mean, good God, these planes were fully gassed and armed. You know, one stray torpedo plane comes over the top and lets loose with his 30s, he could turn your whole flight deck into an inferno. So, yes, was Nagumo playing a relatively conservative game? Yeah, kind of, but so far as he knew, you know, during the first series of attacks that have been rolling in against him, he's demolished every one of them. So why should I expose my carriers to greater risk by trying to spot a group of aircraft on my flight deck while I'm still undergoing these ineffectual attacks? Far better to keep them in the hangars, I think.
Which
sounds like
which,
it would have made sense from that perspective.
Yeah, it's easy for us in hindsight to look back and say, well, you know, Jesus, the guy was an idiot and he lost the battle. But we have to understand that he was fighting this battle on a flagship that had no radar and where he is making decisions in a bridge that's no bigger than a three-season porch. He's under constant attack. He's been, you know, there have been people dropping bombs on him from B-17s during this time, you know. So the ship is maneuvering around. You got anti-aircraft guns going off. It's an incredibly noisy, difficult place to be making decisions in. And, yeah, I guess I just – I don't think that Nagumo was a great leader. Don't get me wrong. I don't think he was a rocket scientist in terms of admirals, but I have a fair amount of sympathy for the guy in terms of the environment that he was placed in and was having to operate under extremely sketchy and conflicting intelligence information. And frankly, you know, they were so far behind the eight ball from an intel standpoint and a scouting standpoint very early on in the battle, it's hard to play catch up. Carriers are not the kind of a weapon system where you can just say go and, you know, all of a sudden 50 planes fly off the flight deck and they go and hit your enemy. I mean, from the time Nagumo could say go, it would take 40 minutes to get those planes up on his flight deck and warmed up and ready to go off and hit somebody. So it's kind of a battle in slow motion in a lot of regards. Sorry, I'm being long-winded.
No,
that's okay. That's
getting it
across. Well, yeah, Mike, can you stand by one? Because I do have to take a quick station break here. And, gents,
absolutely,
if you'll stand by with me for about 2.5 minutes, I would be most appreciative. Now then, just when you think you've heard everything, the leftists in D.C. pull something else, are going to keep on doing it until we, the people, run them out of town on a rail. But what about in the meantime? What are you going to do to protect your family, your property, and your sacred rights as an American when the left-wingers try to redistribute food and who knows what else in the name of social justice? Don't wait for the left to turn our whole world upside down. Get ready now. Make sure you can provide for your family in an emergency by going to the Patriot Depot, America's best-known warehouse, for all your patriotic gear and survival needs. Just go to our website, conservativenationmedia.com, and click on the Patriot Depot banner. There you will find everything from the emergency food supplies to the patriotic gear you'll need today and in the future. That's Patriot Depot at conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. More with Barrett Tillman, Tom Cleaver, and John Parshall coming up, so don't go away.
Welcome back to The Cat Show. Up next, we have Nico. Nico is a member of the Shelter Pet Group.
That's right. A group known especially for their sunspot sleeping, ball chasing, leg rubbing, couch purring, bed leaping, and of course, companionship.
Wonderful. And what breed would you say Nico is?
I'd have to go with a tabby-ish Persian kind of mix.
Tremendous cat.
I'd also like to point out her coat's wonderful mix of colors. Is it black, gray, gray-black, brown?
Somewhere in between.
Indeed.
You know, it's always special when we get to see a cat like this.
Just look how she struts.
It's like she owns the place.
And how she's so incredibly cute in her indifference to commands.
A strong-willed feline.
Ah, and see how she curls up and cuddles her person.
The pitch on her purring is simply perfect.
Nice one. I know. Fantastic cat. Fantastic indeed. But really the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Nico is to meet one.
Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
Nurse, set up an IV. And you, her boyfriend. You were the driver?
Yes, doctor, but I didn't mean to hurt her. I only had a few drinks. I was just buzzed.
Just buzzed? Oh, then your girlfriend is fine.
Hey, sweetie. I feel great.
She's really okay?
What, are you kidding? No. Not really. Nurse, get me a suture kit. Stat.
Buzzed driving. Maybe we should stop acting like it's no big deal. Buzzed driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Hello, I am Robert Garding of the New Wise Conservatism radio show, heard on Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 Central, through conservativenationmedia.com. Being on the air since 2007 from behind the silver CNN microphone of freedom, we've helped people become more informed to keep socialists out of the White House and Congress. But that work isn't over yet. Tune in Saturdays at 4 p.m. Eastern on CNN for the New Wise Conservatism radio show, the voice of reason in our unreasonable world.
Aren't you glad the so-called fairness doctrine doesn't apply here? You're listening to Duke Books on conservativenationradio.org.
All righty, welcome back to this Wednesday, June 4th edition of Radio Free America. Today is the 72nd anniversary of the Battle of Midway. A very important battle in World War II. Some people would describe it as a crucial battle. And I am joined by authors John Parshall, Tom Cleaver, and Barrett Tillman. All three names, if you are a student of World War II, you will know who each of these three guys are. And Mike Greco is still on the line with us from Chicago. John, we have been talking about the early in the day American attacks against the Japanese fleet. And finally, the American dive bombers show up overhead. And Barrett, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Allied air weapon that sent more enemy combat tonnage to the bottom in World War II than anything else, the Douglas SBD Dauntless dive bomber?
Well, certainly the Dauntless sank more combatant tonnage in 1942, that is, in the first year after Pearl Harbor, than the rest of naval aviation combined. And, in fact, it might even be about as much as the rest of the Navy combined. SBD, Sugar Baker Dog, defines the mission. It was a scout bomber built by Douglas based on a mid-1930s design from Northrop that was picked up when Douglas purchased Northrop's El Segundo, California facility. And fortunately for the Allied cause in World War II, the same design team stayed, and that was headed by a self-taught engineer named Ed Heinemann. Wonderful, wonderful guy, bordering on a genius, simply because he was largely an intuitive engineer. And, of course, as I mentioned earlier, I was blessed as a youngster in my early 20s to get personally familiar with the Dauntless that my family restored and flew for a period of about 3 years in the early 70s. And the SBD was designed to perform two tasks. Number one, of course, was dive bombing. And as an institution, the U.S. Marine Corps and shortly thereafter the Navy, after World War I, started looking closely at the best way to hit a moving ship. And there was only about three ways to do that. One was with level bombers, such as the B-17, which just didn't work. The second was steep angle dive bombing, and in the U.S. Navy, high angle dive bombing was about a 70-degree dive. And any of your listeners who have flown aerobatics or played around with other airplanes know that if you look at the 70-degree angle on your instrument panel from the pilot seat, that looks a whole lot like 90 degrees. It's extremely steep. and you're hanging forward in your shoulder harness. And of course, the third way of attacking ships was with torpedoes. And there was an institutional rivalry between dive bombers and torpedo pilots. The torpeckers, as they were called, said, "If you want to let air in from the top, drop bombs. If you want to let water in from the bottom, use torpedoes."
Right.
The problem is that the U.S. Navy ordnance hierarchy, bureaucracy, had inflicted, and I use that word advisedly, the Mark 13 torpedo upon naval aviation. And
that's a proper term.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Didn't work.
Yeah, it was designed and deployed in the late 20s, early 30s. And at that time, during the Depression, funds were short, and the ordnance bureaucracy not only declined to test the Mark 13 torpedo empirically and thoroughly, it prevented the fleet units from doing that. And consequently, both the airdropped and the submarine launch torpedoes were vastly ineffective in not just in 1942, it lasted well into 43. I think by the time that the fleet squadrons and the deployed submarines got reliable torpedoes, that is, those that would run straight and blow up when they hit the target, as the Japanese torpedoes always did, it was probably the fall of 1943. So
actually, an interjection there, that also applied to our destroyer launch torpedoes as well.
A good point. Yes.
I was having a conversation a while back with Trent Hone, who's a pretty well-known researcher when it comes to the gun actions in the Solomons, and I was talking with him and Rich Frank, who's pretty much the man when it comes to Guadalcanal, and between those two guys, they were like, I cannot think of a single instance in any of those night battles in the Solomons where there is a confirmed torpedo hit from an American destroyer. And it's probably the problem being there, of course, that those battles were all fought at night, and so you had no idea, you know, whether or not your fish actually hit, whereas, you know, a lot of the American submarine skippers are like, well, I saw the damned thing, you know, and it, you know,
well,
hit the side
like
of
the
Japanese ship and do anything. But anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to steal your...
It's as the Japanese said at Midway, was that the American torpedo bombers dropped too far out, plus
yes.
The torpedo ran so slow that it was easy to step around it.
Yeah, well, and particularly against a pretty fast-stepping ship like Hiryu or Soryu that could, you know, knock down 34 knots if they needed to. Yeah, they could outrun that fish if need be. Although, to an extent, the speed advantage is somewhat overblown in that if you execute a hammer and anvil attack correctly and you launch...
Off each bow.
Yeah, on each bow, it doesn't really matter if that torpedo is a little bit on the slow side. You know, the ship is in big trouble because there's no way to really get out of that. But anyway, yeah, point well taken. Barrett, back to the SBD. Sorry, man.
Oh, sure thing. The Dauntless's most distinctive recognition feature is the dive brakes and the landing brakes with holes perforated in them, top and bottom, and I was openly proud.
The SBTC had that also.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's where it came from. I was openly proud after restoring our Dauntless that I could actually tell Ed Heineman something he didn't know about the airplane, and that is that the diameter of those holes in the dive flaps is exactly the diameter of a tennis ball, which is roughly 2 1/4 inches. And by splitting those flaps, so you have dive brakes extended into the slipstream top and bottom on the wing, that slows down the airplane, makes it not only controllable, but very stable. And consequently, U.S. Navy doctrine typically was to hold the dive, which would begin at roughly 12 to 14,000 feet. You're looking at 240 knots indicated airspeed, roughly a 30-second dive to release at 1,500 feet.
Yep.
Pull the handle, suck up the flaps, shove up the power, and recover fairly low on the water. Now,
they're pulling 6 or 7 G, aren't they, at the bottom?
Yes. Yes,
right.
Frequently they were, depending upon at what altitude the pilot wanted to recover. And understand, this is in the days before G-suits. So the pilots and the radiomen and gunners were grunting and flexing their abdominal and chest muscles as a sort of organic anti-G suit. But still, at 6 Gs, which is what means a 150-pound aviator is going to weigh, what, 900 pounds?
900 pounds, yeah.
That's a tremendous amount of abuse. And these guys practiced religiously. They would fly numerous sorties per day, dropping practice bombs. So they got really good at it. And I know we've discussed Dick Best, and to me he's Mr. Dive Bomber because he was a very close student of the game. And I remember him saying that he always preferred, when he could, to dive from the target ship's bow because it forced you to get really steep.
Yes.
And that's even more impressive for his pinwheel hit on a Coggy because, John, I think it was broad on the port beam, wasn't it?
It's right in the middle of the flight deck. He puts it practically on the number two elevator.
Yeah, but he dived from the port beam.
Oh, yes,
he,
yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't understand your question. Yes, that's exactly what he did. And those three planes, you know, he put Weber and Kroger on either of his wings, and they dived in a V formation, which was counter to doctrine. Typically, you want to come down sequentially about four to 5 seconds apart, but they didn't have time to do things by the book. So, they come down in a V formation. The bombs come down in a V formation, and it's the bomb in the center that actually hits Akagi, and, it, you know, that's got to be the center plane, and that's Dick Best.
You bet. The rule of thumb in any kind of bombing, but especially dive bombing, and the little bit that I've done bore it out, range errors always exceed deflection errors. So that means that you're going to be long or short more than you're going to be left or right.
Yeah.
And that works very well if you're bombing a ship, either from the bow or from the stern. But here's Dick and his two JOs bombing... From their perspective,
bear in mind, though, he may have initiated that attack from bow on, but Akagi was already in a very hard starboard turn. And so probably what ends up happening is in the course of his attack, you know, she goes through 90 to 120 degrees worth of turn even as he's coming down on her. And
good
that's,
point.
That's why, you know, that the apparent angle of attack is from the port. But...
In about a six-minute time span, the Japanese suffered three aircraft carriers put out of commission. All three of them ultimately sank. And that's the kind of capital loss that nowadays could, you know, could someone imagine what the consequences would be if the United States lost the Nimitz, the Enterprise, and the George H.W. Bush or the Ronald Reagan all at once?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Well, and then they lose Hear You in the afternoon, too. Put that into context, but it really is tantamount to a national catastrophe. I mean, these are ships that represent years' worth of labor. They're huge price tags. And they only had six big flight decks. I'm sorry, Tom.
And that they can't replace. You know.
Yeah, they did not replace those Midway carrier losses on a unit by unit basis until mid to late 1944 when the fleet carrier Taiho comes online.
Yeah.
So they've effectively thrown away their trump card. You know that they had carried into the beginning of the war. They had more flight decks, certainly with the addition of their light carriers into the mix. But they walk out of Midway, and now things are really at a sense of parity.
You know, to put the numbers in rough perspective, I think these numbers are fairly accurate. Throughout the war, that is from 41 through 45, the Japanese commissioned about 11 aircraft carriers of all sizes. On VJ Day, the U.S. Navy had 99 escort carriers alone, plus...
Yep.
What, I'm going to say roughly 20 Essex and Independence boats.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's just a deluge of steel.
Yeah, well, and not only that, but we had built another 30 escort carriers and given them to the Brits.
Yes, correct.
So, yeah, I actually have a slide that I use in one of my talks that just kind of goes through the carrier production on a 6 month by 6 month basis. And yeah, the last slide, you know, I can tell you that the Japanese ships are really shoved pretty hard over to the right edge of the slide. Because, yeah, we put a lot of steel in the water very, very quickly.
Well, not only that, there's the other fact that between 39 and 45, the Japanese trained 7,500 pilots, and then between 42 and 44, we did 150,000.
I disagree with that, because I know that the Japanese during the course of the war lost 40,000 planes.
No.
I know they trained more aviators than that. They may not have been carrier-qualified aviators, but...
I think that's what I... I forgot. That's what I was... That was my point, was carrier aviators.
Yeah, no, I'd totally buy that.
And
yeah,
we trained at least 50,000 of those 150,000.
Yeah, well, our total production of combat aircraft in World War II was something approaching 300,000. And Barrett, you would probably know better than me.
You know, that's a good figure, correct. And I think we winged about 60,000 Navy and Marine pilots, and the Army Air Corps had, I want to say around 190,000 pilots.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the type of materiel and human production that we couldn't even begin to think about today.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. I mean, we live in a day and age where losing a single stealth jet is practically, you know, front page news. And, you know, World War II, we're losing, I forget the figures, is, you know, 70 to 100 airplanes a day or something like that. It's just, it's an enormous amount. And a lot of them are non-combat sort of things, you know. You've got a pretty quickly trained pilot, and he's trying to land it on some crappy airfield in New Guinea, and, you know, oops. You know?
Well, and also, just here in the continental United States, I recently had occasion to look at the Army Air Force statistics. And in the United States, in the 48 United States, we from 42 to 45, we lost 14,000 airplanes and 15,000 Army aircrew without a bullet or a gallon of Axis gasoline being involved.
I can believe it.
It was just the cost of doing business.
Yeah, just
Jesus.
The cost.
That is.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, speaking of the cost of doing business, there's one thing I'd like to remind people about Dick Best. While he made that attack that morning, when they suffered the oxygen problems on the outbound strike, and he had to reduce flight. Back in those days, a lot of people in America had been exposed to tuberculosis, and it was and it was latent in them. And when he landed back aboard aboard Enterprise from the morning strike, he was coughing up blood. He was basically he was in the throes of his first tuberculosis attack.
Yep.
And he still managed to man his airplane that afternoon and go out and go after the Hiryu.
And
he
hit
spent
her.
He spent the next 15 years of his life fighting that.
Yeah.
I heard that he had tried to, Lieutenant Commander Richard H. Best, U.S. Navy, was checking an oxygen breathing tank or something of that nature, and there was a contaminant in it, and that exacerbated it.
The
caustic
tank,
soda or something like that, I believe.
Yeah.
The breather tanks were kind of like a submarine it was a system that was later quickly replaced, but it was almost like the submarine rebreather outfit for a submarine escape, as he explained it to me. And it had some sort of there was a mixture that would take the CO2 out of the air you were exhaling into it, and that those salts,
hydroxide.
That was what ended up sort of almost it made fumes, and it got into his lungs, and that's what brought about the attack.
Yeah, I think that's right.
We've got about 3 minutes left. Barrett, tell us about your latest book, USMC Fighter Squadrons of World War II.
Well,
we've
that's
got
actually
about
one of
3 minutes.
I'll give you the short version. Marine Fighter Squadrons of World War II is from my British publisher, Osprey, which is linked, I think, with Random House over here. And it's one of these last-minute grabs at history. I no longer know any Marine combat aviators from World War II, so the personal stories in there were from my previous affiliations. The other two books are one's also from Regnery. It's the update of the 2004 D-Day Encyclopedia, and some tourists are taking that book with them to Normandy this week for the D-Day anniversary. And then the other one is the first ever history of the 15th Air Force that conducted the southern half of the strategic bombing campaign in Italy from 43 to 45.
You are prolific.
And those are available by, yes, Regnery and Osprey. Anybody that is a fan of World War II kind of technical books is going to be familiar with Osprey, because they've published something on everything from pistols and jeeps up to the B-29 and every stop in between. Tom, tell us about your book, Fabled 15.
Fabled 15
We've got about a minute and a half.
Okay, Fabled 15 quickly is the history of the top-scoring Navy air group of the war, Air Group 15, their six-month tour on the USS Essex, in which they took part in both the Marianas Turkey Shoot and the Battle of the Philippine Sea, to their final being Leyte Gulf. They were led by Dave McCampbell, the Navy's Ace of Aces. Right now it's an e-book. It's available at Amazon, and it will be out this fall in hardback by Casemate.
Cool.
Fantastic. Now, speaking of, speaking of D-Day, on Friday, Barrett and Tom, the three of us will be talking about D-Day. Bob Doerr won't be able to join us, but we'll fix that up. But Friday night, June 6th, 8 to 10, Radio Free America Special Edition featuring Barrett Tillman and Tom Cleaver to talk about D-Day. It's going to be an awful lot of fun. John, do you? We only have a few seconds. Do you have a new book that you're working on?
I am continuing working on a new operational level history of the year 1942. So all the fronts.
Yes.
Yeah, Eastern Front, Pacific,
fantastic.
The whole shebang. And it's a big project, and it's probably only about half done. So talk to me in a few more years.
Well, you ought to get a PhD by now based on what you know about Midway. Have you thought
Academia
about
is overrated.
I understand.
Amen.
I'm with you on that 100%. Yeah, you got it, guys. Gents, thanks so much for being with me tonight. I really appreciate it, and let's do it again at some point soon.
Absolutely. It was fun. And thanks to our callers for
thanks
the great
so
questions.
Thanks so much, guys.
Yeah,
all
thank
right.
you all
Absolutely.
For the really good questions.
Yep,
really
catch
up.
Outstanding job, gentlemen.
Bye, guys.
All
Take
right.
care.
See you on Friday night.
Bye.